previously.tv podcast network.
Love, infidelity, it's just a bag of what ifs.
You can't not lead with that quote from Case Detective when your husband's your guest on a true crime podcast. That's right, folks. Dan's back to discuss Paula Zahn, Ryan Ferguson, and the Girls Bike Club in The Blotter Presents, episode 29. Hello, everyone. This is The Blotter Presents, the true crime wing of the previously.tv Haunted Mansion podcasts. I'm your host, Sarah D. Bunting, and I'm here with returning guest and enduring husband, Dan Patrick Brady. Hi, honey.
Hi, honey. Hello, America.
Today, we are discussing two cases. One is on the return of On the Case with Paula Zahn, and the other one is a case that occurred, a murder that occurred on Halloween. But let's begin with our most wanted section. On the Case with Paula Zahn returned this past Sunday night for its 16th season, which might explain some of the shortcuts the show is very obviously taking. But first, let's get into the case synopsis of the season premiere. Betty Gray and Rita Roundy were found shot to death on July 24th, 1989 at Roundy's home in Idaho Falls. On one wall, "Satan Loves You" was written in human blood. 3 years later, Betty's widower, William Gray, was charged with two counts of first-degree murder. Okay, so it's not that this case isn't compelling on its own, but the way that they present the case on the show really is not. Dan, you pointed out something to me about the way that our host, Paula Zahn, is questioning some of the people involved in investigating and surviving the case. Can you talk a little bit about what you noticed that I then could not unsee?
Yes, I shall elucidate. Let me, first of all, preface by saying that prior to meeting you many years ago, I first started watching this show as a way of falling asleep, and now I remember why. Because... it was so, sorry, Paula, so dull. It just became obvious to me after watching the first question and answer from Paula and the people in the show that they obviously were not in the same studio and that she was not actually giving them any questions at all. She was probably just sort of reading something that was handed to her by a production assistant prior to taping or something like that. It was truly, truly awful.
It's really bad. I mean, this is chock-a-block with reenactments that are not only poor, but also each one is repeated three or four times, like the shell casing bouncing melodramatically and out of focusedly on the floor and then rolling sadly away to symbolize the blah, blah.
Yeah, we saw 18 shots of a guy walking down a hallway with a gun.
Yeah.
Pointing the gun. When they were talking about romance, we saw the same shots of clicking champagne glasses. Didn't depend upon romance. It was two different people who were romancing, but romance came up and there was the champagne. Click, click, yep. Click, click. that what I really found absolutely hilarious was, and I we haven't even gotten into the story, so I don't know how much I should talk about this, but the they mentioned early on that there was there were bike tracks found, and no one rode a bicycle in the house and something. And then slowly but surely, the bike begins to come back into the story. And when they finally start showing the reenactments of the bike, it's very important to the actual facts of the case, that there was a wool seat on a girl's bike. So the reenactment photos, it's the world's largest, wooliest seat under a man's behind that you have ever seen. And they keep showing you that same clip long before they brought up the wool. All from the introduction of somebody riding the bike, you're seeing a man's ass on a girl's bike in a giant wool seat to it, you know? So immediately,
and it's not a girl's bike either.
No,
it's absolutely not. It's not a women's bike. It's not a girl's bike. And readers of my other website, tomatonation.com, may remember that anytime someone says the phrase girl's bike, it's like a bat signal is put on the wall of my brain. So that was amusing. Let me just skip ahead actually to this clip that was like the only fun I had in the entire episode. It's actually clip 9.
There was a bicycle leaning against the wall. It appeared to be the same bike the security guard described.
There was the bike. A girl's bike with a wool seat.
And, you know, cue yet another shot of this reenactor's tuchus on the wool seat. Like, we believe you. Fuck. Like, they showed us actual crime scene photos. Before we get into some discrepancies between the crime scene photos and the reenactments that Dan Brady in particular finds chafy, I'd like to get back to the idea that Paulazan is not in the same studio and in fact has never seen these people. Once you notice that her questions sometimes are so awkwardly phrased that it's obvious that a PA asked a list of questions. They did the interviews with the people, with like the victims' families and with the investigators. That was played for Paula, and then she like mustered up her most concerned face and asked the question, and then they just dropped it in ahead of the interviewee's answer. So once you notice that, and also that she clearly like knocked Aaron Moriarty down and stole her blue half zip, you can't unnotice it. But on top of that, the questions themselves are so asinine, like even for a show like this, just beyond, like, to the point where I actually have like 7 clips that in a show like this, you're always going to get a couple. It's like, tell me how it felt to know that your, you know, loved one was dead. Like, so they got to get the ball rolling and fill time somehow. And I get it. But every single question was like stonatory of the highest order and kind of rude. And then there's one particularly classic response from one of the victim's daughters. But all right, let's begin the cavalcade of stupid questions with clip 2.
There was a U-shape of red candles on saucers. In the middle of it, it says, Satan loves you.
What do you think the killer was conveying?
That this is a satanic murder.
No shit, Sherlock.
This detective manages not to be like, fucking duh, Paula. Okay, clip 3, phrasing issues.
I asked them if that was a joke. I didn't believe it.
That's a brutal way to find out that your mother was killed.
A word?
Is there a non-brutal way to find out that your mother has been killed?
Yeah. No, I don't think so.
No.
And then, no.
No.
Here's clip 4, which is like re-asking this, and you know, I hate, like, how hard was it to X in these situations? Like, what do you want, a scale of 1 to 10 answer? But anyway, here's clip 4.
How hard was it to break the news to your sister?
How do you know, tell that to your siblings, you know? It was terrible.
I mean, can you imagine the guy's probably like relating the story to this PA sitting there and he's going, it was really hard to talk to my sister. And I, you know, I had to go and I had to tell her all these things. So, of course, the obvious question is leading up to, was it hard to tell it to your sister?
Yeah. And this is why I think it was definitely like, well, why don't you just tell the story and then we'll shoehorn these questions in?
Yeah, I mean, why is Paul Lazan even there? Because you could just put the camera on these people and let them tell their story, and you don't need Paula to ask the leading asinine question.
Just get Alexa to do it. Alexa, ask me some questions about my loved one's murder. I will say, Sarah Cussey, who is one of the victim's grown daughters, had a pretty tangy response to the stupid question in clip five. Let's have a listen.
You and your mom were really close. Just how devastating was the news?
I couldn't share my impending pregnancy with her, so I told her while she was in a body bag.
I'm sorry. This is terrible what happened to this family, but there's something kind of, it's almost like she's throwing shade at Paul Lazan with that answer. I kind of love it. Like, how devastating was that news? Like, it was okay. I just told her that I was pregnant to her body bag. Like, shut up, Paul Lazan. Oh my God. It's bad.
Yeah.
I mean, Team Sarah Cussey. But the stupid questions only gather steam as after a number of dead ends go nowhere. Oh, you wanted to talk about how many different people they slander in this program before actual killer.
I've noticed this before leading in some of these shows and stuff like that. And I'm wondering, like, is there any legal recourse that some of these people have? I wrote down Leon Levitt, some poor guy who actually discovered the body. And he's then outed on the show of having had a relationship. He was married, so he was having an illicit relationship. Cue the champagne glasses with one of the people who got shot. But he is, I mean, they like literally say, this is the murderer, till they go, wait, no, he's not. Then J.D. Dwyer is, or Dyer rather, is brought into it. Then a Hugh Riley is brought into it. Then Hugh Riley's wife is brought into it because he was also having an illicit affair with somebody.
I think one of their kids was also libeled. Like, what is it? Well, the kids knew about it. And also, could anyone account for the whereabouts of Elvis Presley at the time of the murder? Like, get to the point.
Hillary Clinton, I'm telling you, Uranium One.
Oh, yeah.
Somehow,
her emails.
Like, yes, exactly. But it just, I thought to myself, first of all, they show all these poor guys. They go back like 30 years or something like that. They show pictures of them. And I'm sorry, you will not look good in a photo that's 30 years old. You're going to be wearing something stupid. Your hair is going to be totally out of sync with what it is today. Believe me. And so that's bad enough for these poor people. But then to be brought up on like something, I mean, they just restarted their lives. They're going on about, you know, it's 2017 and they've met someone new, and all of a sudden they turn on the TV and there's Leon Levitt.
Leon,
you know,
Leon, he, what did you do?
Yeah,
what
exactly.
Is that shirt?
So,
I mean, Not that the victims escaped this either. Like, they got the usual like three photos and they're doing the Ken Burns pan and scan. These are perfectly pretty ladies, but Rita in particular, it was just not a cute picture. Like, this is the best her family could do. Okay.
Yeah.
Although who knows if you ever get these photos back. Anyway. Return with me now to the cavalcade of stupid questions by Paul Lazan. We are now in the trial phase. They finally figured out that it was Betty Gray's husband who killed her. I think he knew about the affair, but he was like, no, that, you know, it's fine. I love my wife and I wasn't there. But it was probably because he had an insurance settlement on her, which they said was $250,000. And you and I are both like, that's it.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
We're horrible people, but it's like, if you're going to kill your spouse, hold out for seven figures. cares?
Exactly. You got to be worth a couple of million at least, I think, if I'm going to even risk it, you know?
Yeah. I'm going to hell. Anyway.
And I have to bring up the fact that they, part of this, the reason they found the guy was they did a sketch of the guy. An eyewitness had seen him, a security guard had seen them. And so they did a sketch and they said, and this looks amazingly like William Gray, who's the killer. And you look at the sketch and the sketch does not have a beard. Every picture of this guy, including films of this guy going back 50 years, he has a beard. When they take him and put him in jail, he's got a beard. There is nothing on this sketch that relates to a beard. The only resemblance is a receding hairline and eyeglasses. So if that's how they got him, except for the bike with the bulbous thing to protect his hemorrhoids, I was amazed by that. Anyway, done. Sorry.
Yeah, no stupid questions are asked about that, I suppose, because they'd never stop.
Right.
But let's hear what it might have been like to testify against your own parent. Because who knows? It might have actually been kind of cool. Clip 6.
Describe to me what it was like to testify against your father.
Spoiler, she was sobbing. Clip 7.
Describe to me the moment the verdict came down.
Spoiler, it was upsetting. Hey, guess how this family and the other family have struggled after the deaths of their loved ones for really no reason.
What did Bill Gray take away from you and your family?
My kids will never meet their grandmother, you know, and she was such a cool lady.
I'm sure she was a cool lady. She's definitely cooler than the pathetic treatment that she's getting in the show, which is really boring. Like, it is everything that is embarrassing about true crime. Like, it's not even comfortingly dull. It's aggravatingly slipshod and bad. Like, the sketch, the Jeep. Oh, tell them about the Jeep.
Well, no, it's just that it was the wrong make and model entirely. It was this is me getting a little bit crazy, but I do get crazy when they don't even get anything close to the same automobile that they're describing in the reenactment. And so this was a Jeep as opposed to an International, which was a make and model from the 60s, and I think it died out like the early 70s or something like that. So it's not important to anybody else in the entire world, but it was important to me, so I wrote it down.
Folks, I had to stop watching that Dennis Quaid show, Vegas, not just because it was bad, but because I thought my then-betrothed was going to have a stroke in his eyeball because the cars were 2 years off from when the show was set.
I'm going to point this out to everybody just so you can understand, okay? It said it was set in 1962, and what rolls in the frame but a 1964 Thunderbird? I know it. It annoyed me. They should take just an iota of, like, care when they do these things, okay?
Well, they took iota. They needed to take more of an iota and find a 1962, whatever the hell.
Thunderbird, yes.
Uh-huh.
Bullet Thunderbird, as opposed to. Anyway.
Okay.
I'm done.
Anything else on the car reenactment tip?
No, these shows are just like, I mean, this is incredibly interesting. Like, what made this guy become this jerk who murdered people? I mean, he murdered not only the wife, but he also murdered the friend and did the satanic BS thing, and then sat around in the house for several hours smoking cigarettes and drinking Mountain Dew.
And then he vacuumed.
And then he, well...
That is my favorite part of the reenactment, is that
I don't remember them saying he vacuumed, but they showed him vacuuming.
And it was an old vacuum, too.
Probably
it was like
wrong
an old canister-style vacuum with like a accordion hose and this like the Mountain Dew is like looming doomily in the foreground, along with a menthol that has not quite been put out. And then in the background of the shot, out of focus, he's vacuuming.
Yeah, but it could have, I mean, the subject matter is incredibly interesting and they don't even really try.
No, they really don't. No, I mean, I take your point. I'm sorry to get us off topic with the vacuuming, which Dan does the vacuuming in our house, peek behind the curtain, folks. So perhaps you just stuffed that part and didn't want to think about it. We have some cats. It's a problem.
More than you need to know, honey. Please.
I know, but they can probably hear the cats in the background of this recording. So welcome to our home. But I take your point that this actually is an interesting case in that, you know, where does this come from all of a sudden? And like, was it the affair or the money? Or like the investigators are like, oh, no, it was about the money. But we don't really get into that. I mean, he sort of never admitted that he did anything and died in 2010 in prison. Spoiler.
Yeah. And but I mean, here's the thing of like really delving into how the kids feel about the fact that their dad killed their mom. It's pretty obvious. I mean, they did a civil trial because they couldn't get them to do the criminal trial first, you know, so the kids knew definitively that their dad had done it. And there's a story there about, my God, how honestly do you feel about this horrible situation, you know? And do they explore that? No, they do one stupid Paula Zahn interjected question, and that's gone.
So yeah.
They spent 5 seconds on that.
Yeah, because what is that conversation like?
Yeah.
You're just sitting around like playing Pinochle, and it's someone's like, you know, I don't want to be the first one to say it, but I think he did do it. And everyone else is like, oh, me too. Thank God you said something. And then how do you pick a lawyer and how do you like communicate to him? Like, we love you, but we're going to sue you for wrongful death because you totally killed her.
Yeah.
And there's also not a whole lot of pushback against the investigators falling so easily for the satanic explanation, which, P.S., it's never fucking Satanists, okay? They don't advertise.
Yeah, that reminded me so much of one of your favorite things, the McDonald killing.
Oh, my God. Acid is groovy, kill the pigs. Like,
yeah, exactly. Write that on the wall. Oh, that'll throw them. You know,
edgy.
No.
Really? You murdered your family. Fuck off.
Yeah.
All right. Well, en conclusion, I totally understand why you used to watch this for soothing purposes. And I remember watching a couple episodes with you at bedtime and thinking like, well, I'm glad Paula Zahn is, you know, keeping busy. Off the streets, not getting in trouble. But now it's just like, oh, girl. I mean, she looks great. Her hair is flawless, but this show is bad. And if she really wants to do something in this genre, she should insist on better. That's what I think.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that wraps up our most wanted section, which means that we're moving along to the cold case section. As we are recording this, it is Mischief Night, but as you are listening to this, it will be, first of all, my mom's birthday, All Saints Day, but since it's Halloween week, we thought we would focus on a crime that had occurred on Halloween. This one occurred Halloween of 2001. This is a 48 hours called Wrongfully Convicted, which is like, that's the whole title? 48 hours has been on since like the 1870s. Wouldn't they have used that episode title before? No?
Is that
thoughts
a question?
On that?
What, me?
not really.
I'm sorry. I thought maybe it was a question to the listeners out there. Like, think about that for a moment. Let's ask Paula. So.
It is. And get back to us at previously.tv/forums. let me know. It just seems like, it's like when SVU titles an episode Lost, and you're like, really? Because I feel like that's been an episode title at least 12 other times. Anyhow.
It probably has. So.
Ryan Ferguson actually ended up hosting a show about possible wrongful convictions that he was investigating with the help of various attorneys and Innocence Project researchers around the country. It was on MTV. It was called Unlocking the Truth. It only had the one season, which I thought was a pity because it was quite well done, and he wanted to do it because he had been wrongfully convicted. Here is the case synopsis in case you're not familiar. In the early morning hours of November 1st, 2001, 48-year-old Kent Heitholt was murdered in the parking lot of the Columbia Daily Tribune, that's in Missouri, where he worked as a sports editor. On the same evening, 17-year-old high school junior Ryan Ferguson and another junior, Charles Erickson, were attending Halloween parties in the area. Ferguson and Erickson later decided to go meet Ferguson's sister at a bar called By George because a bouncer who worked there would let them in despite being underage. Eventually, they got kicked out of there by, I think, Erickson's sister, maybe Ferguson's sister. Anyway, on the night of the murder, Erickson wasn't just drinking, but was taking cocaine and Adderall. The following day, he had had no memory of what had transpired. Apparently, that indicated to him that he did it, because a couple of years later, he called in his weird dreams tip to the police, or a friend of his did. And he pretty promptly threw Ryan Ferguson under the bus. He said that they both did it. Then he changed his story for trial. Then it changed again later, and then again. But at trial, Erickson was able to give a detailed description of Ferguson strangling Heitholt, despite apparently not remembering any details following the murders and during the interrogation. The defense noted that all of the evidence found at the crime scene pointed elsewhere, and none of the hair, blood, or fingerprint evidence collected at the crime scene were consistent with Ferguson or Erickson, nor were any traces of the victim's blood found on the vehicle Ferguson was driving the night of the murder. However, Ferguson was convicted of second-degree murder and robbery and sentenced to 40 years in prison. Ferguson finally got one of those headliners to work on his case. 48 Hours originally covered the case in 2005, but caught up with him after his release, which I believe was 2015. Erickson is, as of this recording, still in jail. Probably because who even knows which story is true, but I'm pretty sure anything involving Heitholt is out the window. But that really didn't stop the investigators from just deciding that he was the guy, as we'll hear in Clifton.
Whoever did kill Kent may have left clues. Police found hair, fingerprints, bloody shoe prints. They also spoke with the janitors. One could not provide a detailed description of the two men he saw, but the other, Shauna Orndt, did. Police released a sketch and fielded dozens of leads. All dead ends.
It just doesn't seem possible that anybody could hurt him. And being as nice as he was, why?
2 years passed with no breaks in the case, and then a tip came into Crime Stoppers. Chuck Erickson told friends that he was having dreamlike memories of the crime. He soon found himself in a police interrogation room.
It's just so foggy, like I could just be sitting here fabricating all of it.
He didn't seem to know many details.
Can you tell me exactly where this happened?
Even when they took him to the crime scene.
The parking lot is right there. Does this look familiar to you?
I don't remember most of what happened.
Okay, cool. Then you obviously did it. Bye.
Yeah.
I mean, I forget, did you watch the confession tapes on Netflix when I was prepping for that episode with Annabeth
Yes.
Chow?
Yeah.
So this really put me in mind of that. And it really
right.
seems like so many of the true crime documentaries that I watch lately have to do with confessions that were obtained under duress, or from people who were obviously altered or not able to really defend themselves in an interrogation.
Ironic. It also that this is on 48 Hours, because if you watch 48 Hours, how many times have you seen some important case-breaking police interviews or something like that, where they go, well, this is proof that he obviously did it. Or at least I think I've seen it on many occasions.
I mean, their ability to, like, draw, not parallels, but just to, like, draw conclusions from very sketchy evidence indeed. And certainly they got no argument from the prosecutor in this case, as we'll hear in clip 11.
None of the physical evidence, nothing tied Ryan or Chuck to the scene. You're talking here about a very messy crime, and yet there's no physical evidence that connects him to the scene.
If I've got physical evidence at the scene, that's great, but I don't go, I can't prosecute this case if there is no physical evidence.
Boone County prosecuting attorney at the time, Kevin Crane, spoke to 48 Hours in 2005.
Are you saying then, really, what most convinces you that Chuck and Ryan Ferguson killed Kent Heidhold is Chuck saying, we did this?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Good job, Kev.
Yeah, I mean, I
believe Kevin was on the long list of people Ryan Ferguson sued, and with good reason, because, dude, like, oh, confession's totally reliable. I'd rather have that than blood spatter. Like, are you crazy?
The irony of that was the fact that I watched this episode, like, literally a day or 2 days after they were broadcasting the tape of Harvey Weinstein trying to seduce or coerce, rather, that poor model. That I don't know if you remember that when he had she had accused him of sexual molestation. She went to the police in NYC, and they set her up with a wire, and she went back and met him again. And he basically, on the wire, admits that last night I grabbed your breasts and did this.
Oh, yeah, no, I heard it.
And our Manhattan DA says, oh, that's not enough. But you've got this clown who's going to throw somebody in jail for the rest of their life saying that that this is evidence.
Yeah,
I couldn't believe that.
Based on the half-remembered drug and booze-addled dreams of some kid who doesn't exactly remember where he was, like, talk about negative capability. And then, I don't know. I mean, I wish just once on these news magazines, like, I love that Aaron Moriarty's like, so what you're saying is you're a dill hole. And he's like, mm-hmm. And I do like that she will lean on that a little more and not, like, 48 Hours is what it is. And it's not, like, whatever. It's not The Staircase, but they do what they do really well. And they're not just like talking heads, lollipops, answer, you know, asking questions that were created for them by some 23-year-old. But I totally lost my train of thought. Neat.
Well, I would just like to bring up that I mean, for the longest time, I've not been a fan of the death penalty. This is a perfect example of why.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you cannot go back. You can't. First of all, this guy, I mean, he's very fortunate in the fact that he's a good-looking young white kid whose parents had enough money that they at least did Facebook campaigns in his favor.
Well, and his dad, like, put that rap stuff that you can put on your car, like, on a Dodge Charger, and it was, like, the free Ryan Mobile, and he drove hundreds of thousands of miles.
I mean, at least he had a committed parent and stuff like that to help him make that happen. But he still lost, what, 10 years of his life?
Yeah.
That'll never be returned?
Yeah.
But can you imagine if he had done this in Texas? He might be dead now.
And if he were African-American?
Yeah.
Forget it. And Erickson is still in jail. Because Erickson did not have, I forget her name, but she's quite a famous, like, get them off the chair attorney.
And she did this pro bono.
Yeah.
for him, and I'm sure she may have done it for very altruistic reasons, but I mean, just thank God she's there. You know, what happens if you don't have a good attorney?
Well, I mean, even if you do have a good attorney, sometimes it's hopeless. I mean, actually, that's our last clip, is Ryan talking about that at the press conference after he was released.
To get charged for a crime you didn't commit, it's incredibly easy. To get out of prison, it takes an army.
Yeah, this point is made many times, like in New Yorker articles about trying to get people, you know, trying to get people new trials, that the system is extremely reluctant to admit that it made mistakes of any kind. And you almost never will see a prosecutor being like, yeah, we fucked that up. Like, even with the West Memphis 3. And I think that was a, you know, I think that was something that his bosses told him to do. But this poor ADA had to go out there and be like, we think there's sufficient evidence. Like, he looked super uncomfortable and bummed out about having to do it, because newborn babies are like, those kids? Nah, they didn't do it. The other stepdad did it. Like, yeah, he did. But they had to take an Alford plea because it was like, they are going to try them again. And you don't know what's going to happen. They already lost 20 years. So it's...
You don't know what's going to happen.
Think it should be cinchy to get out of jail, because as they say in the Shawshank Redemption, like, everybody's innocent in here. You know that. But I don't know. Like, that's... I mean, the system is stacked against everyone, but it's like... Ryan Ferguson, who I think is, you know, great. Like, I liked his show. I think he's, you know, taking his light out into the world in a good way. But he had the best possible positioning, and he still languished in there for a decade.
Yeah, it's remarkable. I mean, the idea, how much money plays into this, how much politics plays into this, it's frightening. It really is. And I have a feeling, you know, you have this concept that justice will prevail, et cetera. You know, I didn't do it, therefore they'll find me innocent at some point in time. And sorry, no way, Jose.
Yeah.
You know, like, especially you, Jose.
Even if they do, sometimes.
Yeah.
Tough.
Yeah, the other kid that's in there, he's in there because he was... incredibly stupid. He went to the police maybe to do the right thing. I mean, who knows, you know, but now he is stuck in there for how much longer? And he has no recourse, none at all.
And on top of that, he has basically nothing to do but sit around and think about how he screwed himself and Ryan over completely, and that the system allowed it to happen. And also, Who fucking killed this guy?
Yeah, that guy's still out there. Hello.
I mean, the internet has theories about that, but that's a job for Reddit, not a job for us. Both these shows will be linked in our show notes. If you had the drowsy misfortune of enjoying the Polizon season premiere, let us know. Shout back at us at previously.tv/forums. And we will also link to this episode of 48 Hours, which is pretty good. It was pretty thought-provoking given recent prestige true crime stuff. And I will also link to my Unlocking the Truth coverage, because I thought that was a pretty good show. And I believe you can still watch it on MTV.com. Dan, do you have anything to plug before we go?
Was that the police coming for me to plug something?
Yes.
Yes. I have nothing to plug except thank you all for your wonderful support of my wife, who works incredibly hard and deserves it. So
that is very sweet of you, Dan. Here's our booking sheet for upcoming episodes. Next week, we'll be talking about Lifetime TV movie The Lost Wife of Robert Durst, starring Catherine McPhee, and our episode will be starring a cavalcade of Smash fan stars, including Tara Ariano, Adam Grossworth, and Kevin O'Keefe. After that, we'll be discussing yet another Joe Berlinger project, this one on the Clutter murders, which were the subject of In Cold Blood. And as always, you can catch up with me and my girl Tara on the Blotter Presents Summary Judgment, where we discuss Law & Order True Crime, The Menendez Murders, the longest title in television, every week after the episode. My name is Sarah D. Bunting. You can find me on Twitter at Tomato Nation. You can find this podcast on Twitter at Blotter Presents. You can find it there on Facebook as well. My guest is my husband, Dan Patrick Brady, who's on Twitter at Dan Patrick Brady. And we'll talk to you next week.
Bye, America.
This has been a production of the Previously.tv Podcast Network.